All right. Hitler's War by David Irving. The Dilemma. For 20 years, Adolf Hitler had dreamed of an alliance with Britain. Until far into the war, he clung to the dream with all the vain, slightly ridiculous tenacity of a lover unwilling to admit his feelings are unrequited. Goebbels watched this undignified scene with disquiet, revealing to his diary on the first day of August 1940, feelers from here to Britain without result, via Spain as well. London is looking for a catastrophe. As Hitler told Major Quisling on the 18th, after making one proposal after another to the British on the reorganization of Europe, I now find myself forced against my will to fight this war against Britain. I find myself in the same position as Martin Luther, who had just as little desire to fight Rome, but was left with no alternative. This was the dilemma confronting Hitler that summer. He hesitated to crush the British. Accordingly, he could not put his heart into the invasion planning. More fatefully, Hitler stayed the hand of the Luftwaffe and forbade any attack on London under pain of court-martial. The all-out saturation bombing of London, which his strategic advisors Raeder, Jodl, and Jeschenik all urged upon him, was vetoed for one implausible reason after another. Though his staffs were instructed to examine every peripheral British position, Gibraltar, Egypt, and the Suez Canal, for its vulnerability to attack, the heart of the British Empire was allowed to beat on unmolested until it was too late. In these months, an adjutant overheard Hitler heatedly shouting into a chancellery telephone, "We have no business to be destroying Britain. We are quite incapable of taking up her legacy," meaning the empire. And he spoke of the devastating consequences of the collapse of that empire. The views of the Duke of Windsor may have colored Hitler's view of the British mentality. It was reported from Lisbon that the Duke had described the war as a crime, Lord Halifax's speech repudiating Hitler's peace offer as shocking, and the British hope for a revolution in Germany as childish. The Duke delayed his departure for the Bahamas as long as he could. Undiminished though his support for the Führer's policies are, reported the Lisbon ambassador, he thinks it would be premature for him to come right out into the open at present. Ribbentrop cabled his Madrid ambassador to send confidential word to the Duke's Portuguese host, a banker that Germany was determined to use as much force as necessary to bring Britain to the peace table. It would be good if the Duke could stand by to await further developments. Firmly escorted by Scotland Yard detectives, the Duke left, however, for the Bahamas on August 1st. In his last conversation with his host, he replied to Ribbentrop's message. He praised Hitler's desire for peace and reiterated that had he still been king, there would have been no war. But he explained that an official instruction by his government to leave Europe for the Bahamas, he had no choice but to obey. To disobey would be to show his hand too soon. He prearranged a code word with the bunker for his immediate return to Lisbon. From an agent in the State Department in Washington, Hitler obtained copies of the current dispatches of the American ambassador in London, Joseph P. Kennedy. Kennedy was predicting that the Germans had only to continue the blockade. Britain's East Coast harbors were already paralyzed, the rest badly damaged. This was Hitler's view, too. To Goering, it was one more reason not to sacrifice his Luftwaffe in preparations for an invasion, which he believed would never take place. "If the losses we sustain are within reason," recorded Goebbels, after conferring with Hitler on the 6th, "then the bombing operation will proceed. If they are not, then we shall try new ways. Invasion not planned, but we shall hint at it subliminally in our propaganda to confuse the enemy." Hitler, it seems, was transfixed by his own foolish amour for England. On August 6th, the Army's chief of staff complained in his diary, "We now have a peculiar situation in which the Navy is tongue-tied with inhibitions. The Luftwaffe is unwilling to tackle the task which they first have to accomplish, and the OKW, which really does have some Wehrmacht commanding to do here, lies lifeless. We are the only people pressing ahead." To his Berlin lunch guests on the 8th, Hitler airily explained that the weather was still not good enough for bombing London. He then returned to the Berghof, where he awarded Frau Bormann the Mother's Cross in gold for her considerable procreative accomplishments. And he inspected the new beehives Bormann had laid out, as though there were no more pressing problems at this hour in Germany's history. At the Berghof, the tapestry was drawn aside at one end of the great hall, and a cinema screen was set up at the other. Every available Russian and Finnish newsreel film of their recent war with one another was run and rerun, while Hitler and his staff studied the Russians, weapons, and tactics that the films revealed. The intelligence reports now reaching Hitler were unmistakable and disconcerting. A gigantic rearmament effort had begun in Russia. In addition, according to Reinhard Heydrich's reorganization, the Soviet trade missions were spreading communist propaganda and organizing cells in German factories. One day at the Brown House, the Nazi Party headquarters in Munich, Hitler had told Ribbentrop that he did not intend to stand idly by and allow the Soviet Union to steamroll Germany. Ribbentrop begged him not to contemplate war with Russia, and he quoted Bismarck's dictum that with about the unwillingness of the gods to allow mere mortals a peek at the cards of fate. When Keitel submitted a handwritten memorandum against waging war with Russia, if it could possibly be avoided, Hitler summoned him to a private interview and scathingly reduced the field marshal's arguments one by one. Stalin had as little intention of adhering to their treaty as he did. Moreover, he pointed out, Stalin was alarmed by Hitler's military successes. Keitel was hurt. Without a word, he turned on his heel and left the room. Hitler retained the memorandum. Presumably, it vanished into a safe along with his collection of other incriminating documents. Keitel had already, on August 2nd, instructed his staff at the OKW that the Führer now recognized that Britain might not collapse that year. In 1941, the United States might intervene, and our relationship to Russia might undergo a change. The OKW's Admiral Canaris was also briefed in August on Hitler's intention of attacking Russia in the spring. The OKW issued an order camouflaging the buildup of German strength in the East and transparently, or perhaps super cunningly, codenamed it Eastern Buildup. Admiral Raeder, however, was informed by Hitler during August in the opposite sense, that these growing troop movements to the Eastern Front, were just an outsized camouflage to distract from the imminent invasion of Britain. In fact, the truth was the reverse. The OKW's war diary stated explicitly on the 8th, Eastern buildup is our camouflage order for preparations against Russia. Hitler's mind was on the shape of the greater German Reich to come, and above all, on how Germany was to police the more turbulent and dissident peoples that would come within the Reich's frontiers. This, he declared to Colonel Schmundt on August 6th, must be the peacetime task of his Waffen-SS. There would never be any need to call on the regular forces to take up arms against their fellow countrymen. These police troopers, noted Schmundt, must be unconditional champions of the Nazi ideology, a body of men who would never make common cause with the seditious proletariat. To increase their authority in the eyes of the people, the Waffen-SS must prove their value on the coming battlefields. They must be an elite. The Wehrmacht objected bitterly to this further entrenchment of Himmler's private army, but Keitel agreed with Hitler's arguments and ordered them given the widest circulation within the army. Goering told Hitler he needed 3 days of good weather to begin the air attack on the British fighter defenses. On August 12th, he announced that the attack would begin the next day. Hitler left for Berlin. When Raeder warned on the 13th that the invasion was a last resort, not to be undertaken lightly, Hitler reassured him that he would first see what results the Luftwaffe obtained. But those who knew him realized the invasion would never take place. Whatever his final decision, the Führer wants the threat of invasion of Britain to persist. The Naval Staff's war diary noted on August 14th. That is why the preparations, whatever the final decision, must continue. The newly created field marshals assembled in the Chancellery on August 14th to receive their bejeweled batons from Hitler's hands. 2 surviving records written by field marshals. Hitler referred to Germany's greatest strength as her national unity. Since Britain had rejected Hitler's offer, a conflict was inevitable, but would be initially restricted to Luftwaffe operations. Whether the army will have to be employed can't be predicted. In any case, It would only be used if we were absolutely forced to. Leib's account is important enough to quote at length. Probably two reasons why Britain won't make peace. Firstly, she hopes for U.S. aid, but the U.S. can't start major arms deliveries until 1941. Secondly, she hopes to play Russia off against Germany, but Germany is militarily far superior to Russia. The film of Russian warfare in Finland contains quite ludicrous scenes. The loss of gasoline, imports from Russia, can easily be made up by Romania. There are two danger areas which could set off a clash with Russia. Number one, Russia pockets Finland. This would cost Germany her dominance of the Baltic and impede a German attack on Russia. Number two, further encroachment by Russia on Romania. We cannot permit this because of Romania's gasoline supplies to Germany. Therefore, Germany must keep fully armed. By the spring, there will be 180 divisions. As for Europe, there is no justification for the existence of small nations, and they particularly have no right to big colonial possessions. In the age of air forces and armored divisions, small nations are lost. What matters today is a unified Europe against America. Japan will have to seek contact with Germany, because Germany's victory will tilt the situation in the Far East against Britain, in Japan's favor. But Germany is not striving to smash Britain because the beneficiaries will not be Germany but Japan in the East, Russia in India, Italy in the Mediterranean, and America in world trade. This is why peace is possible with Britain, but not so long as Churchill is Prime Minister. Thus, we must see what the Luftwaffe can do and await a possible general election. The first 2 days of the Luftwaffe attack on England were a disappointment. The unpredictable English summer foiled every effort to coordinate the operations of Goering's three air forces, A total blockade of the British Isles was declared. But even this was a half measure, for it was shortly followed by an OKW compendium of practices forbidden to the German forces. Hitler called attention to his strict ongoing embargo on the air raids in London, and he forbade any kind of terror attack without his permission. On the evening of the 16th, Hitler again left Berlin for the Obersalzberg. Such hopes as he may have proposed in the Luftwaffe's campaign were temporarily disappointed. At the Berghof, Hitler busied himself less with plans for invading Britain than with other ways of crushing her will. He studied an earlier Brauchitsch proposal that an expeditionary force sent to Libya to support an Italian attack on the British position in Egypt. He also asked Ribbentrop to explore ways of bringing Spain into the war. General Franco, however, was reluctant to declare war, for his country's economy had not yet recovered from 3 years of civil war. Shortly, Hitler had renewed cause for anxiety about the Balkans. After a week of talks between Hungary and Romania on the disputed Transylvania region, war between those two countries became imminent on August 23rd. Romania appealed to Germany to arbitrate the dispute and without consulting Moscow, as he was bound to under the Pact of Stalin, with Stalin. Hitler agreed. Meanwhile, he ordered the German army to stand by to occupy the vital Romanian oil region to prevent third parties, meaning Russia, from getting there first, should the arbitration talks break down. Canaris already had several hundred counter-sabotage troops in the region. When Field Marshal von Brauchitsch visited the Berghof on the 26th, Hitler explained to him the need to safeguard Romania without as yet provoking the Russians too much. He asked the army to move 10 good divisions eastward to the general government and East Prussia at once. The next day, Colonel Schmundt flew to East Prussia with Dr. Fritz Tott, armed with instructions to search for a suitable site for the Führer's headquarters during the coming Russian campaign. One night late in August 1940, British aircraft appeared over Berlin for the first time and dropped a few scattered incendiary bombs. In the early hours of the 29th, word was telephoned to the Berghof that the bombers had again struck Berlin and that this time 10 civilians had been killed. Evidently, the Reich capital now faced an ordeal of fire by night. That same afternoon, Hitler flew back to Berlin. He did not like this new development at all. Rudolf Hess, his deputy Führer, had nightmares, as he told a British cabinet minister a few months later, of coffins, rows upon rows of them, filled with dead children, with their weeping mothers standing behind them. Suspecting that his peace feelers were not getting through the ordinary English people, Hitler asked Hess to establish contact secretly with his friends in Britain. On the last day of August, Hess discussed his extraordinary mission with his old professor, Karl Haushofer, and 3 days later, the professor wrote to his son, Albrecht, "As you know, everything has been prepared for a very drastic attack on the island concerned, and the boss man only has to press the button." Hess asked Haushofer whether he could see any way of setting up peace talks at some other location. Perhaps with the Duke of Hamilton, a Scottish nobleman whom he had met briefly at the Berlin Olympics in 1936. Hess's nightmares of children's coffins gave way to heroic daydreams of flying single-handedly to England. He was an accomplished pilot and of ending the war. He took this mission very seriously and flew to Messerschmitt's Augsburg factory on November 8th to inspect the new ME-110 long-range fighter plane. By the end of 1940, he was flying one solo. In October or November, Hess sent his driver to Munich's local airport to fetch a map of England, and then his valet to Lanai's bookstore to buy 2 maps of northwestern Europe. Once entering Hess's study, which was normally a forbidden sanctum, his valet had found it strewn with carts. Hess asked the factory to fit auxiliary fuel tanks to his ME-110. Once Messerschmitt's instructor inquired why he was asking whether it could still carry a bomb or a torpedo as well as the drop tanks, was he planning to fly to England with the plane then? "No, no," Hess had responded with a smile. Then he hinted to his staff that he was thinking of trying out for himself a new method of mining British ports. In January, he ordered from the Munich sports outfitters, Schuster's, a leather flying suit and fur-lined boots. He had previously borrowed them from Messerschmitt's. Hess's adjutant, Karlheinz Pinch, would tell a fellow adjutant over a glass of beer on April 20th that their chief was worried, because he knew how reluctant the Führer was to destroy England, and because he saw war looming with the United States and the Soviet Union. "He was planning to make personal contact with peace-loving circles in Britain," said Pinch, "and had been working on a memorandum to be handed to Hitler after his departure." In April, Hess would obtain several books on the British Constitution and visit Schwartz, the tailors in Munich's Prielmayerstrasse, to order a blue-gray Luftwaffe captain's uniform. And there's an asterisk to go with this Luftwaffe captain's uniform. The Luftwaffe uniform cost around 150 marks. It gained an almost mystical significance for the superstitious Hess. From that Munich outfitters, it began an extraordinary journey that ended over 50 years later when it was returned by Berlin police authorities to Hess's adult son. It had been stolen from the 93-year-old Rudolf Hess's prison cell in Spandau by British soldiers a few days before his mysterious death in 1987. And that's all the asterisk. Not relying on Rudolf Hess alone, in August 1940, Hitler had simultaneously sent the Berlin attorney, Dr. Ludwig Weissauer, to Stockholm with the task of briefing the British envoy Orly on his peace offers. These included political independence for all the European countries occupied by Germany, including a future Polish state, but excluding Czechoslovakia, an end to the economic division of Europe, and no German claims on the Empire or British colonies. This was, the attorney was to make plain, Britain's last chance of avoiding an intensification of the hostilities. On Churchill's instructions, Weissauer was not even received in the Stockholm legation, and the private letter from Haushofer, which Hess caused to be sent to the Duke of Hamilton via a female acquaintance in Lisbon, was intercepted by Churchill's Secret Service in London. The Prime Minister's response was to order the heart of the German capital to be bombed again. On the following day, Hitler left the embargo on bombing the center of London, but still lifted withheld the actual order. Those coffins of which Hess had dreamed would soon start filling. What is Churchill's deal? Is he getting paid by the Jews? On September 4th, 1940, Hitler delivered one of his most forceful public orations. Oops, thing just caught up there. He mocked the thesaurus of reassuring predictions used by British officialdom to hint at his ever-imminent downfall. For example, they say, "We learn that," or "as we understand from well-informed circles," or "as we hear from well-placed authorities," or "in the view of experts." In fact, they once went as far as announcing, "It is believed that there may be reason to believe." He mocked that after Germany had thrown the Allies out of Norway, they had changed their tune. "We only wanted to lure the Germans up there. What a unique triumph that was for us. After France's defeat, Britain had rejoiced that now she needed only defend herself. And if Britain is now consumed with curiosity and asks, 'Well, why doesn't he invade?' I answer, 'Calm down, he's coming.'" As for the night bombardment of Germany's Ruhr cities that Churchill had begun 3 months before, Hitler now announced he would reply measure for measure and more. "If they proclaim they will attack our cities on a grand scale, we shall wipe their cities out." On the 5th, however, Churchill's bombers came again to the Reich capital, killing 15 more Berliners. Over lunch on September 6th, it was plain that Hitler's patience was at a low ebb. "The Führer," noted Goebbels, "is fed up. He clears London for bombing. It is to begin tonight." Whether Goering had formally been advised that Hitler proposed to fulfill his cherished ambition of attacking Russia is uncertain. Jodl's staff certainly noticed on the 5th that the Reichsmarshal showed no interest in preparing for the invasion of England, as he does not believe it will be carried out. Goering established a headquarters on the Channel coast and personally directed the new air offensive, which opened that night with a bombardment of London, though still only the docks and oil refineries. Hitler's naval adjutant had privately informed Admiral Raeder that a Führer headquarters was already being built for the Russian campaign. On September 6th, the naval chief, whom Hitler had inherited from the outgoing Weimar Republic, arrived at the Chancellery with a series of powerful new arguments as to why Germany ought to concentrate her attack on Britain's Mediterranean positions and on a sea and air blockade of the British Isles. Raeder warned Hitler that it would be impossible to launch both the attack on the Soviet Union, which the Admiral discreetly referred to as the S problem, and the invasion of Britain simultaneously. The Navy preferred the latter attack to be undertaken when the ice in the Baltic was melting, as this would tilt the balance against the Russian Navy. Hitler assured the Admiral that if he did drop the invasion, he would eject the British from the Mediterranean that coming winter, and for the first time he mentioned that Germany and Italy must secure footholds in the Azores, the Canaries, and the Cape Verde Islands. As Raeder summarized it to the naval staff, "The Führer's decision to invade Britain is by no means definite. Hitler again postponed the fateful invasion decision for 3 more days." The Navy tactfully termed the current weather wholly abnormal. The bombing of London had now begun in earnest. It was the blitz that Churchill desired, and Hitler did not. Discussing the new campaign with his lunch guests on the 10th, Hitler again vacillated. "Would Britain now give in?" he asked. "The military share my point of view," wrote Goebbels privately. "A city of 8 million cannot stand for this long. Stand this for long. We have wiped the smirk off their lordships' faces. We shall thrash them until they whimper for mercy." When Hitler assembled his commanders on the 14th with Field Marshal Milch deputized to represent Goering, who was still posturing on the Channel coast, he began with a political survey. Milch wrote a detailed note in his diary. "Moscow is dissatisfied with the way things have gone. They were hoping we would bleed to death." He was giving military aid to Romania because Germany needed the oil, and to Finland because of the balance of power in the Baltic. While it was difficult to see in the future, anything might happen. New conflicts are quite possible. He did not expect America's modest rearmament to take effect before 1944, and he certainly did not want the war to last that long. "We have attained our objectives, so we have no interest in prolonging it. From now on, it would be a war of nerves, with the bomber attacks and the threat of invasion gradually wearing the British people down. If 8 million inhabitants of London go crazy, that can lead to a catastrophe. If we get good weather and can neutralize the enemy air force, then even a small-scale invasion can work wonders." He proposed, therefore, to wait a few more days before finally canceling the operation. If it were dismantled altogether, it would come to the ears of the enemy, and the nervous strain would be that much less. He would still not permit the Luftwaffe to carry out saturation bombing raids on London's residential districts, as Goering's chief of staff Jeschenik had requested. "This is our ultimate reprisal." 3 days later, Hitler postponed the invasion until further notice. His commanders knew what that meant. From now on, the only threat of invasion was to be maintained. In reality, Hitler's mind was elsewhere. During September 1940, foreign diplomats in Moscow reported mounting Soviet bitterness toward Hitler over the controversial Vienna Award and his guarantee to Romania, a guarantee which could only be interpreted as direct against Russia. There were caricatures of Hitler, Goering, and the Nazi Hydra and the omnivorous fascist shark in Red Army barracks. German intelligence learned of a meeting of the Supreme Soviet on August 2nd in which they were warned against trusting Germany because certain information indicated that after her victory in the West, she, that is Germany, would start a war against Russia. Indeed, the officials had continued, "We must get in our attack before our thieving neighbor in the West can get in hers." Under the now familiar rubric of dispersing the forces tightly concentrated in the West, Brauchitsch personally signed an order for additional divisions to move east on September 6th. Two more armies were to join the 18th Army there, the 4th and the 2nd. This would bring up to 35 the number of divisions on the eastern frontier. On that same day, General Jodl ordered the Abwehr to feed to Russian agents false information indicating that the bulk of Germany's strength was at the southern end of the front, and the Russians were to draw the conclusion that we are able to protect our interests in the Balkans from Russian clutches at any time with powerful forces. In fact, for strategic reasons, Jodl's staff recommended that the main military effort at the start of the attack on Russia should be in the north. Here, explained Colonel Lossberg in his draft campaign plan Fritz submitted to Jodl later in September, there were better road and rail facilities, and the Russian influence in the Baltic region could be quickly extinguished. Above all, an attack in the north would rapidly bring Leningrad and Moscow under German guns. Tactically, they must prevent the Russians from withdrawing in strength into their vast hinterland, as they had before Napoleon's Grand Army in 1812. Fritz undoubtedly formed the basis of Hitler's later strategy against Russia. The main thrust north of the Pripyat Marshes was proposed by the colonel as follows: an attack by two army groups from the general line east of Warsaw to Königsberg, with the southern group the more powerful, the group assembling around Warsaw and southern East Prussia, and being allocated the bulk of the armored and mechanized units. Lossberg predicted that resistance south of the Pripyat Marshes would be feebler, plagued by internal unrest in the Ukraine fomented by the Abwehr's advanced subversive operations. The further strategy of the campaign must depend on whether and when Russia caved in under the force of the initial German onslaught. Only one possibility remained open to Moscow: to take the offensive first in order to disrupt the half-completed German invasion preparations, or to invade the Romanian oil fields, perhaps using airborne troops alone. It would be the job of a future German military mission in Romania to forestall such a Soviet move. In Lossberg's view, however, the Russians would be forced for political reasons to try to thwart the German attack close to the frontier. Otherwise, they would be abandoning the flanking positions they had so recently secured in the Baltic and Black Sea coasts. In Romania, the king had abdicated in the crisis that had been triggered by the Vienna Award, and the ruthless but incorruptible General Ion Antonescu had been appointed the national leader and dictator. Antonescu secretly asked Hitler to modernize the Romanian army with German tanks and artillery, and to lend him German staff officers. In return, he promised to deploy his forces exclusively on the Russian frontier and away from the Hungarian. On September 19th, the OKW issued a document stating the real jobs, which were not to be made apparent to either Romanian or German missions members, were as follows: to protect the oil fields from the clutches of the third power and from destruction. That's number one. Number two, to enable the Romanian forces to fulfill specific tasks to a rigid plan aligned with the German interests. And three, to prepare the operations of German and Romanian forces from Romanian soil in the event we are forced into war with Soviet Russia. The reader should be reminded, however, that even at this stage, no irrevocable order for an attack on Russia had been given. Hitler was still only preparing the military machine. I believe that's the end of the chapter. I'll see you again soon. Hope you enjoyed.